Thank you. We appreciate your work.
She appreciates me getting this passage, I think. Yep. It's a little thin out there today, so I'm hoping it's not because of how this passage ended. So go home and tell everybody in your groups that wasn't here how much fun we already had this morning and that you know about trash can turkey. So, last are we? Oh, there we go. Okay. So James begins the verses that we're studying today by telling his audience, the people he's writing to be patient. And in verse 8, he calls for them to stand firm. By coming back to these key ideas here near the end of his letter, he's sort of circling back to how he began, which was with a call to be steadfast and to persevere in the face of trials. And what we learned back then in lesson 1 was that while the pain that we experience in trials, it's real, that joy can be found there as well when we ultimately realize that God used those trials to refine us and to increase our dependence on him and to mature our faith. So that means that ultimately our trials are not without purpose because of what God does in us through the very trials that we go through. So in the verses that we're studying today, James is encouraging his audience to remain patient and to stand firm while they wait for Jesus to return. The difference here, compared to what James taught at the beginning of the letter, is that earlier he was offering encouragement to remain steadfast in the face of trials that were created by external threats, things like the extreme poverty that they were living in and the persecution that they were suffering. Here, James is calling for those same qualities, being patient, being steadfast, in the face of suffering caused by external things, such as we learned last week, how they were being mistreated by some of the rich people, but also in response to internal threats, such as our own tendencies toward grumbling or complaining about other people as we wait for a Lord who has still not returned. And we probably all want Jesus to return and put an end to the pain and the suffering that's involved. It's a consequence of living in a fallen, broken world. But just think for a minute about how much James and the people that he was writing to, how much they must have literally longed for Jesus to come back. We know that James was one of the people who witnessed the ascension on the Mount of Olives. And I found a couple of images online, which I'm going to show you in just a second, that depict what this looked like. And I really like them. I think they're beautiful. But when I was searching for different images, it occurred to me that there is no way any artist could possibly portray what must have happened that day and what these men must have seen. And the best analogy I could come up with to try to compare how impossible that would have been or would be to do is think about yourself if you were standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon and you were trying to explain what that looked like to somebody standing next to you who's blind. You know, how could you convey to them the magnificence of that scene and the amount of space and the beauty and the color and the volume? There's no way you could do it. So as beautiful as these images are, here's the first one. I don't think they come close to conveying what those men must have seen that day. But we know that James saw Jesus lifted up into a luminous cloud, which was a visible display of God's divine glory. Here's another picture that's in color, and it also shows the reactions of the men. So one of those guys up there is supposed to be James. Maybe he's one of the ones who literally fell to their knees because they couldn't believe what they were seeing. So as beautiful as that picture is, I think it had to have been a million times X, the reality of what the men that were there actually saw. So if you were James and if you had seen something a million times X of that, wouldn't you be exhilarated by the thought of Jesus coming back? And now think about the people that he was writing to. They had fled persecution in Israel, and they were now scattered around the Mediterranean. And we know that their lives were really hard. The verses that we studied just last week with Terry were about how their rich oppressors had reduced them to miserable poverty. So besides just implicitly believing in the return of Jesus, I think the grinding reality of their everyday lives must have made those people literally long for Christ to return. Now, in the verses that we're studying today, James tells these suffering people to wait patiently, but expectantly for this second coming. And to help make his point, he uses the analogy of a farmer. And this is the best picture I could find. It's not very big, but you get the idea. He's looking up into the sky, and he's waiting for rain. So a farmer is somebody who plants his seed at the appointed time, and then he has to wait. He has to wait for the fall rains, which will germinate the seeds that he's planted. And then later he waits for the spring rains, which will help those seeds to mature and will guarantee a crop. So this is what he's waiting for at the end of the process that he has to go through. And so this is a good illustration that James gives us of a couple of things. One point that he's probably making is that there's a process that has to be submitted to, a process that has to be gone through. Just like farmers have to wait through the cycle of the seasons and they have to wait for the rain to fall. And in submitting to God's process, believers will inevitably go through stressful times or trials, like when it seems to that farmer that the rains are never going to come. But if we trust in God's goodness, and if we patiently wait during those hard times, we can grow closer to God through that very process. Now, in addition, as one of the commentaries that I read pointed out, this particular analogy isn't probably only meant to teach about being patient like a farmer. We know that James was writing to a predominantly Jewish audience, which means that they were very familiar with their Old Testament scriptures, which means they would probably have picked up on the reference that James was making to Deuteronomy, where we read God telling his people, "If you faithfully obey the commands I'm giving you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will send rain on your land in its season, both autumn and spring rains, so that you may gather in your corn, your new wine, and your olive oil." Now, these Jewish believers lived in an agrarian society. They were very dependent on the land and the crops that they could grow there. So regular rains had historically been one expression of God's faithfulness to his people. So the inference that James was making was probably that just as God has repeatedly shown his faithfulness to his people by bringing them regular rains for their crops, he will also show his faithfulness to them by bringing them justice at the right time. Now, to understand both of those points, the one about being patient and the one about justice coming in God's timing, we saw ourselves as the farmer, right? The one who is patiently waiting for God. But if you take this same picture of a farmer nurturing his crop, and we now see ourselves as the crop or the future harvest, this analogy also seems to fit the idea that James has overall of the Christian life as being a process of growth in which patience is a central requirement as God's hand is at work in our lives. So let's look at that picture again of the germinating seed. God first germinates a seed of faith within us, and then throughout our lives, he cultivates our growth in holiness, hopefully in some fruits of the Spirit. And eventually, God's entire harvest of believers will be ready. Now, the Greek word that James uses to describe the coming of the Lord in today's passage is parousia, which refers to a personal, physical presence. Paul used this same word when he was talking about being a part of the various churches that he spent time with. James uses this same word here to teach about an expected event, when Jesus will return and again be with his people. Now, James may have intended this reminder of the coming of the Lord to bring comfort to these people who we know were experiencing great trials. By reminding them that Jesus would soon return, the implication was that God would then make all of their suffering a thing of the past. Now, obviously, the return of Jesus will literally be a life-changing event for every single person on the face of the earth. But despite how important this event will be, James doesn't go into any explanation about it in these verses, probably because this was a very familiar truth to the first century church. A number of commentaries pointed out that there are 300 references to the second coming in the New Testament. So this literally equates to one reference for every 13 verses. So that's likely why, even though this is now the most important event that will happen in human history, James says nothing more about it here. Now, as I mentioned already, what directly precedes this passage that Terry taught about last week, James excoriated the rich people who were taking advantage of many of the impoverished believers that James was writing to. So another aspect of what James is writing in verse 8, to be patient and to stand firm while waiting for the second coming of the Lord, is that these people didn't need to take matters into their own hands to get justice for themselves. God knows about everyone who's being treated unjustly, and he will mete out justice to everyone in his own timing. When Jesus does come again, all sin will be judged, and all wrongs will be set right. And so knowing this hopefully made the unjust and impoverished conditions under which the people that James was writing to, hopefully it made it more endurable for them. And the same thing's true for us. If any of you have a situation in your life in which you really feel that you've been treated unjustly and the bad guy got away with it, eventually God will mete out justice to that person. But that's God's role, that, and he will do it in his own timing. So you don't need to worry about it. Now, some questions have been raised here about a few other things that James says. That the coming of the Lord is near, and that the judge is standing at the door. Now, both of these might lead us to believe that James expected the second coming to be imminent, perhaps to occur during his lifetime. Well, it's now over 2,000 years later, and obviously we're still waiting. So what does this mean? The Lord has not yet come. The judge has not yet arrived. So what are we supposed to make of this? Were James and the other New Testament writers wrong in their expectation of an imminent second coming? Well, the commentaries that I read made several points that I think are very helpful in understanding how James could be right in describing the second coming as being near, even though we're still waiting for it 2,000 years later. One important point to understand is that God operates in an eternal, timeless sphere, and so his time scale is far different than our human one. This is what Peter teaches in 1 Peter chapter 3, where he writes, "Do not forget this one thing, dear friends. With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like a day." In God's time scale, the return of Jesus, which is the next event in salvation history, it is imminent. It is near, or he wouldn't have inspired the New Testament writers like James to say so. But we need to remember that God's time scale is far different than our human one. And we should think about that term near within the entire context of salvation history. With the death and resurrection of Jesus and the pouring out of the Spirit at Pentecost, what we call the last days have begun, and we are in the final age, and that will climax with the return of Christ in glory. But the crucial point to understand here is that the length of this last age is unknown. Not even Jesus knew how long the last days would be. This is what Mark refers to in his gospel, where he records Jesus saying, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father." And then finally, another important thing to remember about God's timing regarding the second coming is that what seems to us to be a delay is actually part of God's plan for all the people that he still intends to save. If you remember that beautiful picture of the harvest that I put up there, there's more people who are meant to be a part of that harvest. Peter makes this point as well. After he talks about God's timing being different, he writes that the Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. He is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. So now that we've looked at how to interpret the phrases that seem to suggest an imminent second coming, let's look at what James is teaching us about how we should act while we wait. In verse 9, he commands that confident, patient waiting for Christ to return be accompanied by positive relationships with other believers who are also waiting. Now, we all probably know from personal experience, it's one thing to get along with other people when everything's going well. It's a little bit different story when we're under stress or experiencing trials. I don't know if you can read this, but it basically, I thought it was a great picture. It says something along the lines of, yeah, I have my glasses on. Patience is not the ability, I can't even read it. It says something along the line of patience is the ability to keep a good attitude and keep your mouth shut. So when things aren't going well, instead of grumbling like the bird on the right must have been, we need to still try to be patient. James was writing to people who were in a miserable situation, and that was probably causing them to grumble and snipe at each other. So James reminds them. He reminds them of the imminent return of Christ, who will be the great judge of everyone, including believers. Now, being James, that's all he says about that again. Once again, he doesn't elaborate, but probably because his audience was also very familiar with the judgment aspect of the returning Lord. Now, we live over 2,000 years later in a very affluent country, and life for most of us is pretty good here most of the time. And I think both because of the passage of so much time since the New Testament was written, as well as the fact that our lives are, for the most part, pretty nice, I doubt that most of us think as much as first century Christians did about the return of Christ. I mean, I know that I don't. And I would bet that for most of you sitting here this morning, you probably think that the first time that you are personally going to see Jesus is the day that you die, not at his second coming. But as Peter says in 2 Peter, the day of the Lord will come like a thief. You ought to live holy and godly lives as you look forward to the day of God and speed its coming. And I think the point that he's making here is that we don't know when Jesus is going to return, and so we should live the way James was encouraging the people that he was writing to, with patient endurance in the trials that we encounter, combined with eager anticipation and readiness for the day that Christ does return. Now, in verse 10, James teaches again about this idea of patience in the face of suffering, and he cites both the Old Testament prophets and Job as examples. Now, the Old Testament prophets were people who had been chosen by God to communicate on his behalf to his people. And while these prophets occupied a special position, that did not make them exempt from life's problems. And in fact, many of them experienced trials and experienced suffering as a direct result of their calling to be a prophet. Although James doesn't tell us what prophets he has in mind, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and Hosea are all examples of prophets who suffered because they did God's will. But they're also examples of people that God blessed in his relationships with him because they persevered through their trials. And I think the inference for the people that James was writing to, and for us as well, is that doing God's will can sometimes lead to suffering. And when that happens, just like the Old Testament prophets, we are called to patiently endure until God chooses to intervene. Now, Job, of course, has to be one of the ultimate examples of endurance. That's probably why we're all so familiar with that phrase, he or she has the patience of Job. And Job was far from perfect in his responses to what unfolded in his life. And I actually think that makes him more relatable to us, more human. But I think Job is important as a role model because his story is about someone who, despite his sometimes bitter complaints, Job was someone who never abandoned his faith. Here's how one commentary described it. Job's is no groveling, passive, unquestioning submission. Job struggled and questioned and sometimes even defied, but the flame of faith was never extinguished in his heart. And I think the key takeaway for us, as one commentary noted, is that in the middle of his incomprehension about what was happening to him and why it was happening, Job clung to God and Job continued to hope in God. And I think the application that we can take away from all the suffering that Job endured is knowing that God's objective from the start was that Job would know him better, that Job would know God better, know him more fully. That was God's divine purpose, And that's why God allowed Job to go through everything that he did. And we can see God's purpose, that Job would know him more fully in the end of that story, where we see that by then, Job had been blessed with both profound humility as well as great spiritual insight. After going through the fire of all of his trials, Job saw God as he had never seen him before, which is why he confesses, "I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, 'Who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes.'" God allows difficult seasons in all of our lives for the same reason that he allowed Job to go through what he did. Because just like Job, God wants us to turn to him in hard times. And ultimately, through our increased dependence on him, to come to know God better. And I would bet when we look back on the trials that we've all experienced, we can probably see in retrospect that God allowed those hard seasons in order to draw us closer to him so that we would know him better. And as one commentary pointed out, God knows that just like Job, we're made of clay. So he doesn't expect stoic perseverance with no questions and no tears when we're going through a trial. But he does want us to hold on to our faith and to hold on to our hope in him, just like Job did. So James ends his teaching on the patient suffering of the prophets and Job with the second half of verse 11, where he tells us that the Lord is full of compassion and mercy, which is another wonderful encouragement for faithful, patient endurance and a reminder of all the blessings that we have already received. Now, in the last verse that we're looking at today, the last verse of the passage, James has more teaching about how we should act while we wait for the coming of the Lord. Now, he's already cautioned against grumbling as we endure trials. And in verse 12, he returns to what is, I'm sure, our favorite topic, the issue of controlling our tongues, this time with a particular prohibition against swearing oaths. Now, in his teaching here, James is stressing once again that what comes out of our mouths gives a very accurate and very revealing glimpse of our true spiritual condition, what's going on in our hearts. And that's why controlling our tongues is so important. So first, just very brief background on the subject of swearing an oath. In first century Jewish culture, so by the time James wrote this letter, a practice had developed of swearing false, deceptive oaths on anything other than the Lord. Because only an oath, when you swore an oath on the Lord, that was the only thing that the Jewish people considered binding. So if they wanted to trick someone, they might want to try to swear an oath on, you know, their mother's grave or Jerusalem or something else. So that's the background against which James is writing. And in verse 12, we find James teaching the people he was writing to not to swear oaths at all. Now, as one commentary pointed out, and I think both of these were in our study guide as well, oaths are not universally condemned in Scripture. In Acts 2:30, where we find Peter addressing a crowd, one of the things he told them was that God swore an oath to David. I have the verse up here. "Brothers, I can tell you confidently that the patriarch David died and was buried, and his tomb is here to this day. But he was a prophet and knew that God had promised him on oath that he would place one of his descendants on the throne." And in 2 Corinthians, which we'll study in the spring, we find Paul calling God as his witness to really emphasize to these people in Corinth that what he was saying was true. So what James is teaching us in our passage is not that all oaths are always wrong. What he's teaching us is that we shouldn't need to swear an oath in our everyday conversation with people in order to emphasize that something that we're now saying is true. And the reason is because everything we say should always be true. We should be trustworthy people. Our words should be enough. We shouldn't need to have to swear an oath for someone to now believe that we're being truthful. And James takes his teaching here directly from what Jesus taught about this same subject in the Sermon on the Mount. in which he points out that the entire creation belongs to God, which means that you can't swear an oath on any part of it without ultimately referring back to God. Here's what Jesus says. But I tell you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. Simply let your yes be yes, and your no be no. So in terms of the practical application of this teaching for our lives, you can go into a courtroom and take a public oath and place your hand on a Bible, and you're not sinning by doing so. Again, the point that James is making is that swearing an oath shouldn't be a part of your everyday conversation. You shouldn't need to swear an oath to emphasize that what you're now saying is true, because you should always be a truthful person. And if you have that reputation of being honest and being truthful, you won't need to swear an oath in order to emphasize to somebody else that what you're saying is true. Now, note that in verse 12, directly after James teaches us not to swear oaths, he writes, all you need to say is a simple yes or no. And I think there's a really important linkage here between these two things, because if people believe that you mean what you say when you say yes or when you say no, then again, you won't need to swear an oath in order to emphasize that you're being honest. So always being truthful in your speech leads to not needing to swear an oath. And the application for us in our lives is that I think we need to keep in mind that it's really important that when we say yes or no to something, we should really mean what we say, because that's a key part of being a truthful person. As believers, we should be known for straightforward and honest speech. So there's many moms out here, right? So I'm sure all of you, whether you have little children or junior high or high school, or even those of us who had children that age, you probably remember back when you were raising your kid, when you said no to them, you knew that you needed to mean it, and you needed to follow through on your no. Otherwise, it wasn't going to be good for them, and it really wasn't going to be good for you, because they weren't going to believe you later. If you said no too many times, but you didn't really mean it, and you didn't follow through, then the next time you said no, they weren't going to believe you. And I think when you're talking to adults, I think it's almost more important that the yeses are more important than the noes. When you're talking to other adults and you're asked to do something and you say yes, you should really mean it. If someone asks you to do something and you're not sure you can or you want to do it, say maybe if you really mean maybe. And say no if you really don't think you're going to be able to do it. But if you say yes to something, yes, you're going to be somewhere, or yes, you're going to do something, you need to follow through on what you said and do it. Because if you don't do that, you're going to end up with the reputation of someone who doesn't always mean what they say, somebody whose verbal commitments can't be counted on. Now, obviously, that's the polar opposite of the kind of person that James is teaching us to be here. Now, though he doesn't go into any further detail, being James, it's clear that a lack of integrity in our speech has very serious consequences. James does write in the very end of verse 12 that you will be condemned. Now, as one commentary pointed out, James is not saying that this is a salvation issue that's going to change our eternal standing before God. Because if you notice, he begins that verse by addressing it to his brothers and sisters. So clearly, he still sees these people as sincere believers. But he is teaching them and us pretty clearly that a lack of integrity in our speech leads to God's displeasure and may have other negative consequences. Now, I don't want to end here on this negative note, even though this is the last verse in today's passage. So to close, let's go back to a happy place, the last part of verse 11, where James teaches us that the Lord is full of compassion and mercy. Now, we know that God is full of mercy for us as he forgives our sin. But God is also full of compassion as he cares for us when we're suffering. He has a father's heart for us even when he allows trials to come, because those trials are meant to bring us closer to him. Every time I look out and see Helen Swan, it's making me cry, because she's a perfect example of this. So if you are going through a trial right now, like Helen and like many other women in this room, I'm sure, and like the prophets and like Job, you can persevere and you can hang on to your faith and you can hang on to your trust in God. You will be blessed because you will come to know God better and you will come to know that he is a God of mercy and compassion in your heart through your own experience. So will you call this together with me in prayer? So, Lord, I thank you for this passage. I thank you for all the wisdom that James imparts. And I ask you to help us to be more patient people as we wait for you to return. And I ask you to also help us to be truthful people, trustworthy people, people whose word can be believed. And I ask that when you bring those difficult seasons into our lives, that we turn to you. And that through that, we come to know you better. We come to know your compassion and your mercy. And that we hang on to our faith in you and our love for you. And that we will then be blessed because we will know you better.